Hello listener, Steve and I are still planning Series 3 of Not Enough Champagne from our nuclear bunker. So until that's released, here's a selection of some of my favourite bits from the podcasts we did in 2016. First up, here's my favourite introduction of the year. It's from October on our podcast on electability.
Which of us is more electable, based on the research of political scientists?
Based on the research of political scientists, right, okay. So an awful lot of kind of like political science and science says that people choose who they're going to vote for based on kind of like an emotional kind of level, based around kind of like shared values, rather than kind of like rational kind of thinking around this policy will serve me best or serve the country best. So on that, I'd say, just based on the fact that I work in marketing for a living, probably me, because I'll probably be better at actually manipulating that.
I think once again you're right for the wrong reasons. You're not thinking superficially enough. So maybe the biggest reason why you're more electable than I am is because I'm bald. For instance, Britain's last bald premier was Winston Churchill, who replaced the equally bald Clement Attlee. There's some evidence that balding men are underrepresented in politics. So there's a 1990 study that says that 62.8% male officials in Congress had hair, whereas you'd expect that in terms of the population, you'd expect 52.3% of men of Congress with that age to have hair. So it seems like there's a bias against balding men in the US Congress.
So what I'm taking here is that we need bald men shortlists?
I think so. Well, I mean, if you think about it, maybe you could paint the fact the Conservative Party were in the wilderness after New Labour is because they picked a succession of bald leaders. So they picked William Hague, Smith, Michael Howard.
I think that's to a certain degree, I believe that's got an element of truth to it, in that certainly in the modern age, with television, 24-hour news, you need to be telegenic and you need to give an image of youth and vitality, which
I don't have.
Which, you know, having a healthy head of hair certainly helps.
However, maybe the fact that you have a beard might compensate for my baldness. So the last bearded president was Howard Taft in 1913. There's some studies in America which again show that members of Congress with facial hair were perceived as being more masculine, which and not as good as feminine issues. Mm-hmm. So actually, although there's no electoral bias against men with beards, it was found that if women voters and those who defined as feminists were less likely to vote for a candidate with a beard. What I think maybe is the crucial factor in your electability is the fact that your name, your second name, is first alphabetically. So your surname is Haynes, which is H-A-Y. Mine is Hazelhurst, which is H-A-Z.
And so in a runoff between the two of us, I'd be further up the ballot. And
exactly.
Because people are lazy and don't scan all the way down. Although, of course, we probably would end up losing to somebody with the surname Adams.
That's true. Mr. Aardvark, very successful politician. But there's a Barry Edwards for the LSE. He did a blog where he said that alphabetical ordering accounts for the results of 10 congressional seats and 70 seats in other state legislatures in America between 1967 and 2010. There's an article on the bias of alphabetical ordering on ballots in Sex, Lies and the Ballot Box, which is a very interesting book on lots of aspects of political science. And again, that suggests that the effects of being first on the ballot paper might be about 2%, might give you a 2% benefit, which, if you think about it, a 2% swing from Labour, from the Tories to Labour in 2015 would probably have given you a hung parliament that would have a chance of a Labour majority. It's 2% doesn't sound like a lot, but actually is.
Yeah, especially when you're running it across multiple seats.
Yeah. And as you were saying, it's especially alphabetical ordering, it makes more of a difference in, say, primary elections where people, or local elections where people don't know the candidates and they are having to choose almost randomly.
Obviously, you've kind of given a lot of US examples there, but what I will say is that there was a thing I read a while back now, which was looking at the Labour Party shadow cabinet elections as they were at the time. And it basically said that actually, when you look at the number of people who stood, because generally speaking, most backbench MPs would stand for it for the most part. There was something along the lines of very few people who had surnames which began with a letter from the second half of the alphabet ever ended up in the front bench, and they were already well known, because you've got to go through, when you've got about a list of 40, 50 maybe even 100 names to go through, you know who you're looking for, and you go, right, I want those ones because they're my mates, or I'm on their team, and they agree with me. But after that point, and you're kind of going, oh my God, and I've got, how am I supposed to choose between all of these? People just kind of go, well, I've gone halfway down and I like these ones and I guess that'll do. And so they ignore everybody at the bottom of the list.
I wonder if you could go in like NEC elections or ERS council elections, you may probably find a similar thing.
Yeah.
There's also some evidence that this doesn't really apply for female candidates as such, but there's some apparently bias in favour of attractive male candidates. I think it would be the height of pretentiousness to try and do a survey to work out which of us. And I don't think either of us really want to know the answer to that. But I think what this shows is that the concept of electability is quite a fuzzy one. It's quite ephemeral. Jason Zengel wrote an article in 2007 on the concept of electability. He said it was squishy and bankrupt as a political concept. Although things like trust and in a candidate, character of the candidate, whether or not you'd have a beer with a candidate, they are important parts of a candidate's electability, as well as other kind of more silly things that we've started to talk about. What we're probably going to try and focus on in this week's podcast is the electability of politicians with certain views which might be seen as extreme. So can Donald Trump be seen as electable? Can Jeremy Corbyn be seen as electable? To which our nuanced answer is probably going to be, it depends. But we'll talk about it more after this jaunty theme tune. Not Enough Champagne started in June 2016 and began by taking a sideways look at the EU referendum. This next segment was recorded the day after the referendum and looks at why Britain voted for Brexit.
As far as I'm aware, there was one person in my office of about 40 odd people who voted Leave. And amongst my clients that I've spoken to today and amongst the clients that I've spoken to in the run-up to this, none of them were voting Leave. Every last one of them was bemused by the notion that anybody would. When you look at kind of like some of the anecdotal data on all of this, that's the similar kind of situation can be found amongst the kind of people who are voting Leave. They don't know anyone who's voting Remain because us middle class lefty metropolitan types aren't actually going down that working man's club.
Yeah, exactly.
To them, because we've just got completely different lives and completely different social circles, and very rarely do they meet. Class divides determine an awful lot of how you spend your time and who you spend your time with, and it's that class divide, I think, which has led to this kind of inability to comprehend either way.
Andy Burnham said that the Remain campaign was too much hamster and not enough hull.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, talking about working class interest reminds me of football in the Premier League, and I always think that one of the best things the Remain campaign could have talked about is the effect this would have on the Premier League. Now, the Premier League did put out a statement this week saying they were for Remain. The amount of Premier League footballers who, if they were not EU citizens, would not be eligible for an EU work permit, and I'm not, my knowledge is a bit sketchy, but I think it's about the percentage of games you play for your country. So players like Riyad Mahrez, who was Leicester's great French player this season, helped them win the Premier League. He wouldn't be eligible for a work permit if he wasn't an EU citizen. And so the amount of Premier League footballers we could lose is surely a big trump for the Remain campaign. I didn't see it talked about at all.
I do think one of the kind of the flaws of the kind of Remain campaign, one of the big ones was they started talking economics, which is fine. They started talking Project Fear, that's fine. And actually, a certain element of Project Fear was necessary to this kind of campaign, given what they were going up against. So anybody who starts saying, oh, we should have made a much more positive campaign, yes, to a certain extent, but that doesn't mean you're not actually saying, things are going to be terrible, guys, because that's one we've seen today with the market.
You need the carrot and stick,
yeah, exactly. And we had a lot of the stick, but not very much of the carrot.
And that carrot should have been kind of pointing out the contributions that the EU does make. Unfortunately, some of those things, which would have been a lot more obvious, couldn't be used by the Conservatives. So, for instance, whenever there's a flood, there is basically emergency disaster relief available for any EU member to apply for to help deal with the situation. So when Kendal is flooding up north every summer, as seems to be the case these days, all of the money that comes to, a lot of the money that comes in from that EU. In Cornwall, which voted quite heavily to leave, an awful lot of the money that they get for infrastructure comes from the EU. The average person doesn't actually know what the EU does, because unless there's a giant blue plaque which says paid for by the European Union, you don't know, you don't see what they do. And that's, I think, the kind of the root cause, is that it wasn't obvious to a lot of the population what the kind of net benefits were. That's one of the reasons why that 350 million figure was so effective, is because you it basically set up the notion of 350 million, we're paying this, what are we getting out of it?
Mm.
And when you're, and when your response is to go, oh, that's a lie, that's a lie, that's a lie, that's not the accurate figure, it's only 195 million.
Mm.
Correct response to that figure should have been, yeah, and here's what we get.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that you have, if you want to remain in the single market, as it seems most Brexit people do, you'd probably have to pay a lot of that anyway.
Yeah.
But also, I think going back to your point about it can't be Conservatives making those arguments, it's only really Labour that can make the argument that it's not immigration that's harming the NHS, it is austerity and it's spending cuts. But it wasn't an argument that was very, made very often.
No, and I think that boils down to the fact that Labour wanted to have a separate campaign. Completely. And this is one of the kind of the big issues I have, is that you in effect had probably four separate in campaigns actually working at the same time. You've Britain Stronger in Europe, which to a certain extent is also the Conservative in campaign, but they're still doing their own little thing, so we can still count that as those as that as a separate one. You've got Labour in, you've got Liberal Democrat in, you've got Green in, you've got SNP in.
And there just wasn't that coherent message.
Yeah, there was no coherent message behind any of it for the most part. The Lib Dems trying to make kind of a more positive case for Europe along the lines of what I'm talking about. Mm. You've got the Tories with Project Fear. You can't see the air quotes I'm using, but they're there. Labour with whatever the hell Labour had, and that's the part of the issue, is that I can't think of how to actually describe it. The only kind of main elements that I can think of from Labour's campaign are Corbyn appearing on TV and him being half-hearted in his support, kind of making the point and spending half of his time, you know, criticising TTIP. Now, whatever you might think about TTIP, the time to bring that up is not in the middle of a referendum where you are supposed to be leading a party which is on the side of remaining in the EU.
Yeah, I think we should talk more about Labour's lackluster campaign and Corbyn specifically a bit later on. But I always thought if we had a referendum on the EU, one of the reasons why we wrote to remain is because the Remain camp would pick a big figure. It would be like the AV campaign. You pick a big figure. It might be these million jobs are a product of the single market, or this amount is the benefit that immigration brings, or this amount is what the single market gives us. And you repeat that figure endlessly and endlessly and endlessly. Now, there was, as you said, we started with the economics. There was this figure, $4,000 or whatever it was, that each family would lose out. And that disappeared after the first couple of days when no one really took it very seriously. Whereas actually, the campaign that had that figure and repeated it endlessly was the Leave campaign. Not surprisingly, it's the same chaps who run the Leave campaign who ran the No to AV, £250 million, you know, we need a baby, not a new voting system. Leave won because it had the better campaign. It had a much clearer message, but it also had a much better slogan. Take our country back is much better than Stronger In, because, well, Stronger In to do what? I mean, it feels like that going, a recurring feature of our podcast so far has been the fact that EU has no clear purpose. And that was never more clear than when they were trying to find arguments in favour of it.
Yeah.
Now, we're both pro-EU, but I think we both agree, well, the case to remain in is more a 55-60%. It's not an 80-20, it's not a 90-10. You know, on balance, the EU is a good thing.
Yeah.
There are enough good reasons you could come up with, but the Remain campaign didn't come up with enough of them. We spent a lot of time talking about Twitter and politics on social media. One of my favourite parts was when Steve showed why he works in online marketing for a living and explained the different social media strategies of Britain's main political parties.
There's actually kind of three scales which are the kind of the focus of how most people utilise social media when it comes to politics. And those three scales are organisation versus message distribution. So that's, for instance, the two examples there are actually kind of polar opposites. So Black Lives Matter with the hashtags and things, that's message distribution. It's about getting the message out there. And organisation, you mentioned with the Facebook invites to go out door knocking. Those are, in a lot of ways, actually kind of polar opposites when it comes to social media and the way people tend to utilise them.
Hmm.
The second you've got is organic versus paid. Now, when I mean organic, I mean things that are naturally occurring, so you're not paying for it. And whilst obviously on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and any other platform, there are paid advertisements that you can have and use. All of the things that you mentioned there were organic. And then what you have is a third thing, which doesn't necessarily impact on people who are organising stuff for it, but if you're doing message distribution, whether it be organic or paid, it's whether the message that you're putting out is propaganda or whether or not it's based upon facts.
Okay.
So of those three kind of scales, what you end up with are a lot of different ways to utilise social media. You can pick and choose any of all of these different categories and be at various points on all of them. There, whilst I've said it's this versus that, they are scales. You can be slap bang in the middle and doing both. You can lean one way or the other.
And we're probably organic propaganda. I mean, we're still not being paid for this.
Yeah.
And very little of us is based in fact.
Yeah. It's interesting you kind of... All, the first thing you did was to go straight to kind of defining what we are, because that's what I've done with the three of the main parties in the UK, the Tories, Labour and the Lib Dems. Now, I've done these because these are the ones that I'm most familiar with. Obviously, the Greens, the UKIP, the SNP all have their own approaches to social media as well, but I'm not as familiar with them, so I've just ignored them for this. So, and it's what's quite interesting is with the Tories, you see a very... an approach which is very different to all of the others. The Conservatives have one of the reasons that they claim they won the 2015 election was due to their paid social media strategy. They worked with a number of people to put out Facebook ads in targeted constituencies. So if you were in Dudley South, you were on Facebook, they would hit you up with an advert for why you should vote Conservative or why you should not vote Labour. Which is very effective, as demonstrated by the actual general election results. So that's all about paid messaging, which is heavily targeted based on the individuals that you want to talk to. Labour, on the other hand, are much more organic. It's all about kind of just getting the message out there. They certainly in 2015, they weren't paying that much money for adverts. And as such, their social media stuff wasn't as effective. Because all they were doing was they were getting retweets, but they were getting retweets from the party faithful.
Mm.
You know, that stereotypical Twitter echo chain that you hear a lot about and we'll be discussing in a bit more detail later. But what they also did was quite interesting was they did it for organisation as well. So you had a lot of things coming from Labour for sign up so that you can help us knock on those 2 million doors or whatever it was that they were trying to do in constituencies. Now, it turns out, those constituents, the constituencies where doors were being knocked were the ones they already held rather than the ones they wanted to win. But the notion behind it is actually quite a solid thing. They were using organic social media presence to get people out on the doorsteps and actually engaging with people. And the Lib Dems are the third one I want to look at for this. And in some ways, they're quite interesting. Full disclosure, I used to be a member of the Lib Dems, which I think has been brought up on a few previous things, which is one of the reasons why I'm bringing this up, because it's the one I'm most familiar with. The Lib Dems' social media strategy was all about going viral. At various points, you will find that news stories were being made about little funny things that the Lib Dems had done online. So, for instance, after the last load of local elections, There were no Conservatives left on Watford Council, I think it was, or something like that. As a result of that, they changed their 404 error message, so the message that you get when you try and go to a page on a website that doesn't exist, to say something along the lines of, like, the Conservatives on Watford Council, this page doesn't exist. And they did another thing quite similar after Theresa May took power as Prime Minister, saying, like, Theresa May's mandate for being Prime Minister, this does not exist. This page does not exist. And these things get target. They get press attention because they're quirky, they're interesting, and the Lib Dems have got a history of doing this sort of stuff. There was an interview which Joey Essex did before the general election, where he mispronounced the name of the Liberal Democrats to the Liberal Democats. As a result, somebody quickly altered the logo on the Lib Dem site to have a little cat on there. You know, and it got a lot of it got a little bit of press attention, and it was quirky, and people liked it and enjoyed it.
The internet loved cats.
Yes. Yeah, that sort of thing. So the Lib Dem strategy is really good for kind of getting attention. It's really good for getting it organically, but it doesn't do very much other than that. Now, the notion, I think, behind it is you do these fun, quirky little things, people are more likely to follow you, and then when you do your more serious stuff, they're going to actually see it, see the other stuff.
How's that worked out for them so far?
Oh, well, we went from 56 to 8 MPs, so my guess is not wonderfully, although the social media strategy there, in that aspect, probably not the main cause. I do know that the Lib Dems were doing some paid advertising as well, and I do know that had some success in terms of like the metrics we use to measure how successful these things are, but it didn't necessarily translate into seats. So what you've got there are three very distinct ways of utilising social media from three of the biggest parties in the UK. But out of all of them, the Tories are by far the best of being effective in terms of winning elections with it. So my question for you then is, what do you think that means for the political landscape? Do you think that the fact that they're good at doing Facebook ads matters?
Well, the thing that strikes me is that the Tories, as you say, they're good at doing paid social advertising. Now, the thing about paid adverts is that it requires money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Tories outspent both Labour and the Lib Dems at the last election because they have the big donors to do that. So again, maybe this is just an example of how money talks in politics. Now we're finding it through online medium as well. And online, obviously, that famously, it's where you get stuff done for free. Maybe it turns out actually the best way of doing it is to, if you can pay to get that targeted advertising, whether that is with a leaflet, whether that is with a billboard, or whether that is to target people on Facebook. Also, I suppose it's about the work you can do. It's very easy to draw a cat and do a funny little slogan. You know, we've all seen these memes go around, and it's just, but as you say, I don't think that necessarily changes people's minds. I don't think that necessarily will get people to vote for you. It's not the Lib Dem social media strategy that caused them to lose 40 odd MPs. I mean, tuition fees is part of it.
There were lots of things which caused that.
Making lots of silly jokes does not compensate for doing bad decisions in government, or for making unpopular decisions in government. And in terms of Labour's social media strategy, as you say, it turns out that Labour is more interested in talking to itself and talking to its supporters than the wider electorate. Who knew? So maybe the social media strategy is just a
reflection of the wider
mindset? Yeah, it's a reflection of the wider mindset. The Tories have got the organisation, they've got the money. Labour have got the
will, but not
ability to talk to themselves. And the Lib Dems have funny cats.
At the end of our first series, we talked about whether or not we were doomed. As part of that, we had this debate on climate change.
I'm going to say some things in here which are going to be very unpopular. One is frack, baby, frack. That is actually one of the best ways you can actually achieve of reducing carbon emissions, because the gas you get from that is cleaner than a lot of the things we're burning. So you would effectively be able to reduce that quite substantially. The other thing is, we are entering a point where a lot of renewables are on the cusp of actually being quite effective. We are now hitting up the point where, you know, entire days, you know, something like 30% of the grid is being powered by solar power. Now, that's not necessarily as stunning as it sounds, but it's the first time we've ever done that.
So there are lots of ways that we are making improvements in these kind of fields. I mean, I'm a great believer in that necessity is the mother of invention. And one of the reasons we haven't actually gotten to the point where these things are being developed rapidly, although they are starting to be there now. Just look at the electric cars that we're producing. Just look at the advances in solar panel technology, where you're now able to produce solar roadways, literally roads which are just tapped into the grid to enable to power it. You know, these things are happening and they are here, and it's just a case of getting them out there and getting to the point where they are more affordable to happen.
Okay, so in terms of the fracking thing, as I understand it...
I knew you were going to pull me up on this one.
Oh, yes. I've been reading books, you know. I have my facts. Fracking produces more methane when you're excavating, when you're extracting the gas, when you're storing it, and when you're transporting it. And it releases more methane into the atmosphere. Now, methane is a much more polluting gas than CO2. I think it's like 30-odd more times more polluting. So I don't think fracking is the answer. I mean, both from a CO2 point of view, but also from the point of view of we have finite resources. There's a finite amount of coal and gas and oil, and at some point we need to stop getting stuff out of the ground.
Absolutely, I agree with all of that at some point we do need to stop taking stuff out of the ground. But the problem is, you know, what are we going to replace it with?
So at the moment, as you say, there's more renewables. It's a case of having the political will to do it. I mean, you can see in Germany and Scandinavia, there's that political will. There's more of a move to renewables there. I think Germany's got 25-30% of its electricity, which is renewable.
And yet they're still not hitting those targets.
They're not, no. Not
the only country which is coming close in terms of Europe is France, because they're using nuclear power. Nuclear power is the other option. But that, when as soon as you discuss that, the very people who are concerned about climate change tend to get turned massively off and go, "Oh no, we couldn't do that."
Nuclear power is a halfway house. I think it's better than fracking.
Yeah, it may very well be a stopgap,
but it's
a necessary one if climate change is a serious issue, which I think it is, and if there is a potential that it can have massive impact by 2060, as the OECD might suggest it does, then why are we waiting for the perfect solution to come around when it's not here yet, when we could do something which works? That's what I don't get when it comes to nuclear power. Yeah, it's not ideal, but it's a damn slight better than burning coal and gas.
I think the other thing in terms of waiting for things to come along is that what happens is, especially kind of the fossil fuel companies, energy companies, if you leave them to their own devices, what I think they do is, rather than invest in renewable technology, I think they tend to go into things like fracking, go into stuff like excavating the tar sands or drilling under the Arctic ice for more gas, which is more polluting. It's profitable for them, but is still more polluting. So I think it's about having the political will to try and invest in that green technology.
Absolutely, I'd agree with that. And there are certainly a number of government and policy initiatives that you could put in place, and I think some places have put in place, to help try and deal with that sort of stuff. But it is about political will to do so.
Shall we leave it there?
I think that's probably a good place to leave.
Our second series began in September with a post-mortem of the Labour leadership contest, which saw Jeremy Corbyn up against Owen Smith. This is what we had to say about Smith's campaign. It contains a flashback within a flashback. How meta is that?
Of course, the problem is that Corbyn wasn't standing against God. He was standing against Owen Smith,
who's much less impressive.
Well, Owen Smith is definitely not God. In fact, let's go back to happier times 2.5 months ago, to what we said about Owen Smith when he was first standing. But I mean, what seems to be happening is Angela Eagle is preparing a leadership bid, apparently forestalled on Friday, not just because of the Boris stuff, but also because of Owen Smith, who neither of us have heard of.
No, I can hand on heart say that I've been heavily involved in politics since I was 16. I eat, breathe and sleep politics. I have never come across Owen Smith before up until this moment, and neither have you. And it's like, where has this guy come from?
It's like the moment in the thick of it where Claire Ballantyne's advocated as Prime Minister, and the night editor of the Daily Mail says, "I literally have no idea who she is." So what have we learnt about Owen Smith since then?
Well, leadership campaigns are more often than not a way to for a politician to try and define themselves. And the message that Owen Smith was trying to put out, seemingly, was, look at me, I'm just as left-wing as Jeremy Corbyn, but more competent. Which you can see the logic behind it. If the core case against Jeremy Corbyn is that he's incompetent, which, generally speaking, that's what an awful lot of Labour MPs are concerned with, then, you know, it makes sense to try and latch on to the similar kind of policies so that you can appeal to the same people that were attracted to Jeremy Corbyn, and then you can deal with the core complaint of incompetence, and you can just say, look, I'm better all around. I agree with the same things, but I'm just going to be better at the job. So you can see the logic. Unfortunately, Owen Smith is not better at the job. In fact, his entire leadership campaign was filled with gaffes of all of various sorts. So he said he wanted to smash Theresa May back onto her kitten heels, which elicited complaints about that he was kind of talking, alluding to violence against women.
Perhaps one reason why women prefer Corbyn to Smith by about 2/3 to 1/3.
Potentially. So you've got that gaffe. There was the time he kind of implied he had a 29-inch penis during a Q&A session of some sort. I can't remember the exact context, but he was joking about the inside of his inside leg size, but kind of talked about it in a way where it was just like, yeah, I've got a 29-inch dick, mate. So it's
A bit like how he said he was a winner because he'd fought off thousands of men to marry his wife.
Yeah. Bear in mind, 2.5 months ago, we'd never heard of this guy, and we're able to now list off a whole host of gaffes just off of the top of our head. That kind of gives you an idea about the kind of the competence level we're dealing with for him.
The word I could use to the best describe Owen Smith's campaign, I think, is spunky in maybe all versions of the word. But it reminded me of a football team who are kind of 3 or 4 nil down, who then start rallying and score a couple of consolation goals. So, you know, you might lose 4-2 or 3-1 or something,
but you took the fight to them.
In any of the hustings meetings, Smith was being jeered by Labour members, having to put up with the same lie from Corbyn, his supporters, all the time, that Labour were ahead in the polls before the coup, which is just demonstrably not
there
true.
There was one poll.
One poll in a year in which Labour have been ahead.
Yeah, I think the term I would use to describe Owen Smith is actually banter. I mean, when he answered the fabled Mumsnet question about what's your favourite biscuit, he kind of goes, it's a Garibaldi, because you've got to love a biscuit named after a revolutionary. And it's just like, that is the kind of joke that gets made by someone who's a hell of a lot less funny than they think they are. Granted, it was still a better response than Corbyn's, I am anti-sugar, but I would go for a shortbread bread. Owen Smith is the sort of person who probably thinks he's still down with the kids in that kind of way. He still thinks he's actually got knowledge. He'll come out, if he were leader, and say, yeah, my favourite band is insert whatever the biggest band in the charts is at the moment. With Gordon Brown, it was the Arctic Monkeys.
Whereas Jeremy Corbyn's is obviously UB40.
Yeah.
Leading to
One version of UB40. The actual version of UB40 with the good members doesn't like him.
Well, this is the thing where there was a wonderful Chris Brooke tweet during the campaign, and Chris Brooke is an Oxford academic, I believe, who said that, I'm going to stop thinking of the Corbyn media operation as politics and start thinking of it as performance art. And I can't really think of a better illustration of that than using a band from the 80s who no one's ever heard of, which is a great metaphor for Corbyn anyway, but using one which has split irrevocably and can only talk through their lawyers. I feel bad having a lot of hate for Owen Smith, who Bantasaurus Rex, as you've said.
Yeah.
But he was obviously quite articulate. Maybe no one could have won at this point, which is maybe why you end up with a leadership candidate who no one has heard of. Do you think that maybe it would have been different if a Dan Jarvis had run, if a Chukwuemeka had won?
I'm not entirely sure. I think at this point, whoever had run for the leadership would have lost. I think it's a bit up in the air to say that Angela Eagle, for instance, would have done better. I think she'd have made less gaffes.
Mm.
Which I think would have potentially meant that the membership vote might have been a bit more Smith's way. Plus, there's the argument about, hey, we can actually have a female leader. I think she's LGBT as well. I think she's a lesbian.
Yeah.
So you can say, so we've got two firsts in one there, which, you know, symbology matters in this sort of thing, which, you know, as shallow as it might seem, that can and does appeal to people.
But Owen Smith's a normal bloke, he said to himself. He's got a wife.
And he
literally had to fight her out of the hands of the claws of
40,000 other Welshmen, yes. I mean,
that's how they choose spouses in Wales.
That's kind of the problem, I think, actually, is that Owen Smith is just another bloke. He is just another white guy in a suit. So maybe Angela Eagle would have done better. I reckon Angela Eagle may have been able to get that extra 2 or 3% to push them over the top to the 40% mark, which I think in terms of kind of morale for moderates would have been enough to kind of make them go, yes, this is worth fighting for. I think failing to hit that mark, which is like the Smith campaign themselves said that we don't think we're going to win, that 40% is the benchmark, which they failed to reach. I think Eagle would have hit that potentially. I think someone like Chuka Umunna, whilst you can make the argument, yes, we're putting forward the first ethnic minority leader for the Labour Party, and therefore arguably the first potential ethnic minority Prime Minister, the reality is he's too Blairite, he would have gotten just swiped out of the water. And from my personal perspective, I think a lot of talk about him is overblown. And then again, and then you end up with your Dan Jarvis types, who, let's be honest, it's the same problem. There's nothing overly interesting there.
We were lucky to have some great guests on the podcast in 2016. One of those was Bridget Jones. And in this bit, Bridget, Steve and I all have a nice chat about being on the campaign trail. Finally, we must have a section on Donald Trump. So do you, even at local council level, do you kind of get that anti-politician rhetoric?
Oh yes.
Yeah, you definitely do. This is actually one of my favourite memories from just doing some campaigning. I was campaigning for one of the other then Lib Dem councillors who went on to lose the election.
Narrow it down.
Ouch. But Dave Radcliffe.
I like him.
Yeah. Obscure Birmingham reference.
we were knocking up on people for supporters on election day, and I knocked on this one bloke's house, and he comes to the door, and I'm like, "Hi, my name's Steve. I'm here from the Liberal Democrats.
I'm here to help you."
Yeah, we're just here. There's an election today. We're wondering if you're going to vote, and if you are, who you're going to vote for. I then spend the next 15 to 20 minutes stuck on this guy's doorstep as he lambasts me, one for being a Liberal Democrat, two for believing in human rights, and three for thinking that thinking refugees actually need help. Somewhat foolishly, potentially, I stood to my ground and argued with him for about 15 or so minutes, which is something you're not normally supposed to do.
That's the kind of thing us on the Labour Party like to hear. The opposite team tied up on the doorstep.
Yeah, I know.
You sure it wasn't a Labour voter in disguise?
No, he was definitely UKIP. I'm having this argument with him. And after a while, we end up kind of coming to the end of it. And he turns around to me and says, "You know what? I don't like the Liberal Democrats. You know, you believe in human rights and all of these things, and I don't agree with you. I'm voting UKIP, but I don't actually want them to win because they couldn't organise a piss-up in a brewery," to which my response is, my head explodes internally. And then, just to put the icing on the cake, he turns around and basically says, "And your guy Dave, Dave Radcliffe." I'm like, "Yeah, he's a really good local councillor. We always see him around here. So, you think we're a good for the area, you like our local councillor, you're really actually quite pleased that someone's knocked on your door and actually stood the ground and actually had debated with you, because it means someone's actually listened to you, and you're still not going to vote for us." And he's like, "Yeah, no, you're just too establishment." It's like, "Okay, good afternoon, sir. I'm just going to go now," and just bang my head against the wall repeatedly.
When I first started campaigning, the Iraq war was still looming over the Labour Party. And when
thank heavens that issue's gone away.
Yeah. And I'd go to a doorstep as a council candidate and people would say to me, "I'm not voting Labour because of Iraq." And I started saying to them, "Look, I'll make you a promise right here, right now, on the doorstep, me to you. If you elect me to Birmingham City Council, I won't invade any foreign countries."
Robin Cook, also on the doorstep in the 2005 election, apparently got people saying, "I can't vote for Labour because of the Iraq war." And it's like, it's Robin Cook. The man could not have done any more to show he was against the Iraq war.
And people don't differentiate between individual candidates a lot of the time, or levels of government a lot of the time.
Yeah, or indeed the notion if you're just somebody who's given it a go and someone who's actually a slick professional. Anybody who comes knocking on the door and says, hello, I would like your vote, suddenly there is a shift in how you can get dealt with. 90% of the time, it's absolutely fine. Everybody's kind of really polite. Your supporters will be yes.
Yeah.
So your opponents will be, I'm sorry, I really don't like that party or whatever. But occasionally, you just get some absolute kind of abuse hurled at you just for actually daring to participate in the democratic process.
The worst ones are the letters. Really vicious people. Don't do it to your face. They write you a letter in good hard ink on paper and they send it to you.
My favourites are always when we do surveys through the letterboxes and basically tell people, say, if you leave them hanging out in your letterbox, the next half hour or so we'll grab them, nothing drops. And it's just like some of the comments you get on them as part of the surveys are just absolutely wonderful. I remember one just kind of saying how they quite agreed actually with what the Lib Dems were doing in government with the coalition, and they weren't too fussed about tuition fees or and all of that sort of stuff, but they could not stand the fact that it had taken 6 weeks to fill in the pothole on their road, and therefore their vote would be going to the Conservatives. It's like, you're fine with all the shit that actually matters, but because we didn't do this one thing really, really quickly, that's what's costing us your vote.
It is fascinating knocking on doors and talking to people, because they will hold you to account for everything from the Iraq War all the way down to that tree outside their house, that pothole. And when you knock on the door, you don't know what kind of person you're going to get on the other side.
You could end up with a complete revolutionary socialist who's angry that you're not helping overthrow the neoliberal capitalist system.
Why are you door knocking Jeremy Corbyn?
Or you end up with this person who's really, really into the parking regulations. During the 2015 election, I did a hustings with all of the other candidates. And the first question that came up was from this one of the local voters. What's your opinion and how will you resolve the parking issues outside of Norfield train station? And they come to me first on the thing. I'm sat there kind of going, I don't have a fucking clue. Are there problems with parking at Northfield train station?
See,
I don't normally use it.
It's that range that you're expected to know about as a candidate is extraordinary.
Yeah, and the thing is,
keeping up with people's expectations is so difficult.
I think that's why Trump did so well, because he would have said, I've got all the best solutions, I've got all the best car parking, I've got all the best car parks.
Car parks, very important. Love the car parks. We're going to build a wall around the car park.
the worst thing that about that...
We're going to make Celio pay.
The worst thing about that question, though, was just that the Labour MP and my opponent, Richard Burden, was also the Shadow Minister for Transport for Labour. So I'm sat there kind of running through, kind of going, well, it's very important to listen to local people's opinions. And then he just reels off an entire kind of policy manifesto commitment on parking and things like that. And I'm like, okay, fair enough.
It can be very difficult to harness that kind of anti-politics vote, can't it? I remember giving leaflets out for the AV campaign in Stoke. And
how did that go, Corey?
So the AV campaign slogan, as I'm sure you all remember, listener, is was make your MP work harder.
And we had a slogan?
In fact, the campaigners didn't know the slogan is maybe and one of the many reasons why AV did not quite pass. But so you're giving out in a city centre of these leaflets, say, make your MP work harder. Because obviously we're trying to capitalise on that anti-politics vote that was going about. And someone replies that the MP should work harder building their own gallows.
Wow.
And it's kind of when you realise that you can't...
Wow.
How do you harness that anti-politics vote in a positive way? Because as you've kind of alluded to, it's really difficult to get any of the established parties even, you know, it ends up just being a populist outsider doing that. Oh, it needs to be someone like UKIP, or it needs to be someone like Trump, who is just not part of that establishment.
Mm. It was something I found quite hard to come to terms with when I first got elected, and it was the fact that so many people I'd never met and I'd never done anything to in my life suddenly hated me. And they hated me because suddenly I was a politician. and I was getting paid to do politics. So as soon as I got elected, the letters started arriving. Not large numbers, but enough to get under your skin. And people you'd never heard of before, you'd never met, suddenly would write to you because you're an evil bastard lying politician and you definitely weren't going to do anything about this list of things that they were interested in because you're a liar and a bastard and you should quit.
I never had any personally, just because I never won an election, but you still get sent some random comments here and there and the odd email which comes through to you, and you look at the list of things that they're complaining about, and as you say, they're all kinds of random, from local to international, and you look at them and you kind of go, I am in agreement with you on like 90% of these. I would love to do all of these things. However, I'm running for city council. I can do the potholes, maybe.
The reactions of people are so interesting. So I actually started, a few months after I got elected, I started lying about what my job was to new people. I kept the charade up with my driving instructor for an entire year before he saw me on the bloody news at 6 that evening and then blew my cover. But I just lied to him about my job, because I had a previous driving instructor who I'd had to let go because the moment he found out I was a counsellor, every driving lesson it was, so what do you think about Tony Blair? Why do you defend Gordon Brown? I mean, I wasn't defending Gordon Brown. I was attempting to turn left. This is really hard for me. It's my second lesson.
It's also a very bad metaphor.
At least I wasn't trying to turn right. Ooh. Or stuck on a roundabout. So I actually dumped my driving instructor. It wasn't a relationship. It wasn't a breakup. I got a new driving instructor, and I just lied to him. I just said I work for the council and just left it at that. And I mean, obviously, as the weeks went by, he started to ask, "What do you do for the council?" Because I was scheduling lessons at weird times, and you know, turning up sometimes in a suit and sometimes in jeans, where I've been on a litter pick with someone. And he must have queried what exactly my job was on quite a few occasions. But it just made my life easier, and I do that a lot. I lie to people about what my job is. I just say I work for the council, because otherwise, you just see their faces change. When you say that you're a counsellor, that's the worst case scenario. The best case scenario is they go, what kind of counselling? Drugs and alcohol counselling, family breakup counselling.
And the Labour Party, yes, a bit, yes, of everything, I suppose. Finally, it seems appropriate to end our roundup of 2016 with a section on Donald Trump. This was recorded a week after his election victory and features another great guest, Danielle. Are you feeling anger? Are you feeling denial? I think I'm still really experiencing all five stages of grief at once. There's been a few things talking about how we shouldn't normalise Trump, about how we should be angry, about how we can't just accept that what's happening is normal. We can't rationalise it away. Should we be trying to normalise this? Should we be trying to look for the rational kind of centre of this?
I think it really depends on what you mean by normalise. I think that word's been thrown around a lot, and it's got a couple of different meanings. A lot of people are kind of using it to say, oh yeah, we shouldn't kowtow to the racism, to the misogyny, and all of that sort of stuff. And that's absolutely correct. You absolutely shouldn't. But normalisation also means kind of just getting on with it and doing the job of actually, you know, holding things to account and properly. And certainly in the case of the US media, they do need to get back to a normalisation process where they are actually holding the office of the president to account, as opposed to covering all of his press conferences with at the drop of a hat. A lot of postmortems which are happening in the US media at the moment are kind of acknowledging that they managed to miss a load of things, that they either ignored large aspects of the United States, so in those Midwest counties which swung it for Trump, they just completely ignored them for the most part. So that's why they were suddenly shocked by it all. Or they've just admitted that maybe we shouldn't have been at Trump's beck and call as much. Maybe we did have a role in that.
Well, so the what seems to me a manufactured outrage this week is the fact that Trump went for a steak without telling the media. Isn't that just a case of get over yourselves?
Not really, because we're not talking about, he's not just a candidate for office anymore. He, at the time that happened, he is now the president-elect, and it is pretty much vital for the American public to know where their president, current president or future leader is at all times. So there could come a point where there's a moment of crisis for America and nobody knows where their president is,
yeah,
which is not good to say the least.
So is that the important thing then? It's not that he can't go off and have a steak, it's more that if the shit goes down, we need to know where he is.
Yeah. Pretty much,
that's
yeah.
exactly it. I mean, after 9/11, George Bush wanted to quite rightly just get the Dodge out of Texas or wherever it was he was and get back to the Capitol as quickly as possible. He basically got told by a number of his aides, we need to get the press pool going and move them along with us, which is obviously going to take half an hour to an hour. And he was just like, why? Why the hell do we need to do this? And somebody pointed out to him, because if you're up in the air and no one can find you, all kinds of rumours are going to kick off. Everybody is going to start talking, where is the president? And if they don't know where you are, then it's going to look like you've been assassinated, it's going to look like you're dead, and that's going to send panic across all of the stock markets and across the nation as a whole.
Yeah, I'd like to pick up something that Steve said about the media and getting back to basics. I think the most important thing the media could do right now is actually returning to facts and calling a lie a lie. Because at the moment, all they've done in a lot of cases is basically reported something Trump said without and just left out, whether it's true or not, out the headline. And unfortunately, a lot of people just read the headlines these days. Mm. I mean, a classic case this week was where Trump tweeted something bragging about how the chairman of Ford had told him that this plant in Lincoln wasn't moving to Mexico. Meanwhile, it was never actually going to move. Trump was basically using that as a way to try and take credit for keeping jobs in the US, when in fact that really wasn't the case. Given how often Trump lies and just how dishonest he is, that's going to set a very dangerous precedent for the next few years if the media doesn't sort of sharpen up on that.
Yeah, we didn't really talk about the media in last week's show, but I think you can see in the presidential election something that happened in the British press here over the EU referendum, where you kind of get the postmodern normalisation of bullshit, perhaps. Where,
yeah, the post-fact era, as it's called.
Sort of, well, I prefer golden age of political bullshit. I don't like, because basically it ends up being their lies versus our lies. In the case of the EU referendum, in the US, it became Hillary's scandal against Donald's scandal, and they became equated as being the same when they really, really weren't. People like Barack Obama, people like Hillary Clinton, they've said some good things about trying to get a peaceful transition in. So Obama said, we're all rooting for Donald Trump's success in uniting and leading the country. And I'm guessing one of the reasons they're doing that is because one of the worst things that Trump said in the debates was his refusal to accept the result come what may. Mm-hmm. And that kind of violation of democratic norms. But they have to, especially after what he's just said, they have to be quite clear and say, yeah, you won, fine, we're not going to whinge about it, you're going to be president in January.
Yeah.
God help us.
Yeah. And also, I think it's one of the cornerstones of any functioning democracy is the peaceful transfer of power. And I think that, above all, is why Obama, especially being the outgoing president, it's basically his duty to ensure that that happens. So whatever he personally thinks of Trump, and I have absolutely no doubt that he shares our opinion of him, that he has to be seen to be encouraging him, which is why you're now seeing him in this sort of bizarre role of tutor, where he's having to basically coach Trump through the basics of the presidency, because neither he or his team were actually aware of the scope of the role, which he is.
Mm.
It is quite terrifying, and why we're currently broadcasting from a bunker.
Yeah. Thanks so much for listening to this episode, and for everyone who listened to the podcast last year and who shared it on social media as well. Both Steve and I are really quite touched by the number of positive responses we've had and the amount of nice feedback we've had about the show, which is amazing. If you've got any ideas of future topics you'd like us to do, or any feedback about the show, you can tweet us. I'm at Paperback Rioter and Steve is at Centre Radical. Thanks to James Cram, who designed the logo for Not Enough Champagne. You can see now on the website, notenoughchampagne.com, and on iTunes. Also, thank you to Dave Depper, who did the theme tune for the show, which is available on Creative Commons. Thanks to Robbie and Brett Northfield, who often like and share the show. Thank you to Danielle and Bridget for being guests on the show. We're back next week with Series 3 of Not Enough Champagne, and we're looking at the subject of personal responsibility. That will be in your iTunes feeds and on social media next Sunday afternoon. See you then. Bye-bye.